There is a story that a Persian king, one of the most powerful men who had ever lived, was so angry at a small city far away that he made a servant repeat three words to him every single day. Before every meal, the servant would walk up to the king and say, "Master, remember the Athenians." The king's name was Darius I, ruler of the Persian Empire. The city was Athens. And his anger would eventually pull two worlds into a collision that people are still talking about 2,500 years later. To understand why this collision mattered so deeply, you first need to picture the world as it looked around the year 500 BCE. That is about 500 years before the birth of Jesus, or roughly 2,500 years ago. On one side of the Aegean Sea, which is the body of water between modern Greece and modern Turkey, stood one of the greatest empires the ancient world had ever produced. The Achaemenid Persian Empire stretched from the Indus River in what is now Pakistan all the way westward to the shores of that same Aegean Sea. It contained dozens of different peoples, languages, and religions. It was governed by a single monarch who carried the magnificent title King of Kings. This empire had vast armies, enormous wealth, and a sophisticated system of roads, laws, and administration. In short, it was the superpower of its age. On the other side of that same sea sat something very different. The Greeks, who called themselves Hellenes, lived not in one unified country, but in dozens of small, independent city-states. A city-state, called a polis in Greek, was essentially a city and the farmland around it, governed as its own independent political unit. Think of it like this. Imagine if every major city today, London, Paris, Rome, each had its own army, its own laws, its own government, and considered itself a completely separate country. That was ancient Greece. Athens was one polis. Sparta was another. Corinth, Thebes, Argos, each of these was its own world. The Greeks shared a language and a culture, including shared religious festivals and the Olympic Games, but they were politically divided and frequently at war with each other. They were, by any measure of military or economic power, far smaller and weaker than their Persian neighbors to the east. And yet, what happened when these two worlds finally clashed would shape the course of history in ways that almost no one involved could have predicted. The story does not begin with a dramatic Persian invasion fleet arriving on Greek shores. It begins far more quietly on the western coast of Anatolia, which is the large landmass we now call Turkey. Along that coast lived Greek communities in a region called Ionia. These Ionian Greeks were culturally and linguistically Greek, but they had been living under Persian rule since around 546 BCE, when the great Persian king Cyrus conquered the region. Persian rule was, by the standards of the ancient world, often relatively tolerant. The Persians generally allowed conquered peoples to keep their local customs and religions. But for the Ionian Greeks, something still felt deeply wrong. They were governed by local rulers called tyrants, men who held absolute power over their cities, and these tyrants were backed and appointed by the Persian king. The Ionians could not choose their own leaders or make their own laws. They paid tribute, which means they sent regular payments of money and goods, to a distant king they had never met. For Greeks who were accustomed to debating their own affairs in public assemblies, this felt like a kind of slavery. In 499 BCE, the frustration finally exploded. A man named Aristagoras, who was himself the ruler of the important Ionian city of Miletus, helped organize a revolt against Persian rule. He traveled to mainland Greece to ask for military help. He went first to Sparta, which was the most famous military power in Greece, the city whose soldiers were considered the finest fighters in the known world. The Spartans refused. They had no interest in getting involved in a distant eastern quarrel. Then Aristagoras went to Athens. Athens agreed to help. So did the small city of Eretria, located on the island of Euboea. Together, they sent a fleet of 25 ships. In 498 BCE, this combined Greek force marched inland and did something spectacular and reckless. They burned Sardis, which was the main Persian administrative city in the region, essentially the capital of the Western Persian Empire. This act of burning a major Persian city was like poking a sleeping giant with a sharp stick. The Ionian revolt ultimately failed. By 494 BCE, the Persians had crushed the rebellion, destroyed Miletus, and reimposed their control. But Darius I had not forgotten who helped start the fire. Athens and Eretria had insulted his empire, helped his subjects rebel, and burned one of his cities. That was why he needed a servant to remind him every day, "Remember the Athenians." The first Persian expedition against Greece came in 492 BCE. Darius sent his son-in-law Mardonius with a powerful force. It went badly. The Persian fleet ran into a violent storm off the rocky headland called Mount Athos on the northern Greek coast, and many ships were destroyed. The army suffered setbacks in the northern region of Thrace. Mardonius returned to Persia without achieving his objectives. But Darius was not finished. 2 years later, in 490 BCE, a second Persian fleet crossed the Aegean Sea directly, heading for Athens. On the way, the Persians stopped at Eretria, the other city that had sent ships to help the Ionian Revolt, and burned it to the ground. Then the fleet sailed on and landed at a place called Marathon, a flat coastal plain about 40 kilometers, or about 26 miles, northeast of Athens. The Athenians faced a serious problem. They were outnumbered. They sent a professional runner named Pheidippides to ask Sparta for help, and according to the ancient account, he covered the roughly 250 kilometers to Sparta in just 2 days. The Spartans said they were willing to help, but they were in the middle of a religious festival and could not march until it was over. A small force of 1,000 soldiers from the city of Plataea arrived to help, but the Athenians were essentially alone against one of the largest military powers on earth. The Athenian commander was a general named Milcibiades. He had actually spent years living in the Persian Empire and understood how the Persian army fought. He knew something crucial. The Persian infantry were mostly lightly armed, meaning they carried lighter weapons and wore less armor than Greek soldiers. Greek soldiers, called hoplites, were heavily armored infantrymen. The word hoplite comes from their large round shield, the hoplon. A hoplite wore a bronze helmet, a bronze breastplate, greaves which were shin guards made of bronze, and carried both a long spear and a short sword. They fought in a tight formation called a phalanx, a Greek word meaning a block of soldiers standing shoulder to shoulder, shields overlapping, spears pointing forward. It was like a walking wall of bronze and iron. Milcibiades made a bold decision. Instead of waiting behind the city walls of Athens, he decided to attack. He arranged his phalanx in a clever way. He made the center of the Greek line thinner, with fewer soldiers, and he strengthened the two wings, putting more soldiers on the left and the right sides. As the Greeks charged across the plain of Marathon, the Persian infantry in the center pushed through the thin Greek middle. But then the Greek wings swept around and crushed the Persian flanks from both sides, like two arms wrapping around an enemy and squeezing. The Persian army, caught in a deadly embrace, broke apart and fled back to their ships. The result was astonishing. The Athenians lost around 192 soldiers, a number we know precisely because they were buried on the battlefield with great honor, and the burial mound still exists today. The Persians lost around 6,400 men. For the most powerful empire in the world to be beaten so decisively by a small city-state was shocking. The story that a runner raced the 40 kilometers back to Athens to announce the victory before dying of exhaustion is probably a later legend, but it captures the drama of the moment. The word marathon, which we now use for a long-distance running race, comes directly from this battle. The victory at Marathon was more than a military success. It was a psychological earthquake. Persians had been seen as nearly invincible. Now Athenian citizen soldiers, men who farmed and worked and participated in their city's democracy, had defeated the empire's professional troops. Athens would draw on this memory of Marathon for the rest of its history. It became proof of something the Athenians desperately wanted to believe, that free men fighting for their own city would always be braver and stronger than subjects fighting for a king. But not everyone in Athens was satisfied to simply celebrate the victory and wait. A politician named Themistocles was already thinking ahead. He was one of the most brilliant strategic minds of the ancient world, a man who could look at a military problem and immediately see solutions that others missed. Themistocles was convinced that Marathon was not the end of the Persian threat. He believed, correctly, that the Persians would come back and that next time they would come with far greater force. He asked himself a simple question. What does Athens need most to survive what is coming? His answer was a navy. In 483 BCE, something fortunate happened. Workers discovered a massive new vein of silver in the state-owned mines at Laurium, in southern Attica. This was a sudden and unexpected rush of wealth flowing into the public treasury. The obvious and popular idea was to distribute the money equally among all the citizens of Athens, giving every man a share. In the Athenian democracy of this period, most major decisions were made by the citizen assembly, where any male citizen could speak and vote. Themistocles had to stand up in that assembly and argue against giving people free money. Instead, he persuaded the Athenians to use the silver to build 200 new warships. These ships were called triremes. A trireme was a long, narrow, fast warship powered by 170 oarsmen arranged in three banks, or rows, one above the other. The word trireme itself means three-oared, referring to those three levels of rowers. A trireme was a weapon of war designed to do one thing very effectively: ram enemy ships. It had a bronze ram at the front, at the waterline, and skilled rowers could accelerate the ship to tremendous speed and punch a hole through the side of an enemy vessel. To use a trireme well required enormous coordination and practice. Athens spent years training its rowers and captains. This investment in a navy would turn out to be one of the most important decisions in the history of the ancient world. Darius died before he could organize a third expedition against Greece. But his son Xerxes I took up the task with a determination that bordered on obsession. Xerxes assembled what ancient sources describe as the largest army the world had ever seen. The Greek historian Herodotus, our main source for these events, gives a figure of over 2 million soldiers. Modern historians, using geography, logistics, and archaeology, believe the real number was somewhere between 100,000 and 300,000. Even at the lower estimate, this was an army of extraordinary size for the ancient world. Xerxes had the Hellespont, the narrow strait of water that separates Europe from Asia, bridged with boats lashed together so that his army could simply walk across. He had a canal dug through the peninsula of Mount Athos so his fleet would not face the same storms that had destroyed ships before. He was planning with absolute thoroughness. In response to this threat, something remarkable happened among the Greeks. 30 of the perpetually quarrelsome Greek city-states agreed to cooperate. They formed an alliance called the Hellenic League. Sparta, as the greatest land power, was given command of the combined army. Athens, as the greatest naval power, was given command of the combined fleet. This unity was fragile and incomplete. Many important Greek cities refused to join, and some even sent earth and water to Xerxes as tokens of submission, a Persian diplomatic ritual meaning we surrender. But the alliance held together through the critical moments. The Greek strategy rested on a simple geographic insight. The Persian army was enormous, but enormous armies need roads. And the roads leading south into Greece were narrow, often squeezed between mountains and the sea. If the Greeks could hold a narrow pass, they could deny the Persians the chance to use their vast numbers. The most important such pass was Thermopylae. Thermopylae, whose name means hot gates after the warm sulfur springs nearby, was a narrow coastal passage in central Greece. In 480 BCE, it was in places only wide enough for a single wagon. The Persian army could not charge through it in a broad front. They had to come in small groups. A small, disciplined Greek force could theoretically hold it indefinitely. The Spartan king Leonidas arrived at Thermopylae with his 300 royal bodyguards and several thousand allied Greek soldiers, roughly 7,000 in total. What followed was one of the most celebrated stands in military history. For 2 full days, the Greek forces held the pass against the full might of the Persian army. The Persians sent wave after wave of their best troops, including their elite fighters called the Immortals, so named because their number was always kept at exactly 10,000 by immediately replacing any who died. All of them were stopped. The problem was not Persian strength, but Greek betrayal. A local man named Ephialtes, and the ancient sources suggest he may have been motivated by a desire for reward. told Xerxes about a mountain path that went around Thermopylae and came out behind the Greek position. Xerxes sent his immortals along this path overnight. When Leonidas received word that he was about to be surrounded, he sent most of the allied soldiers away. He kept his 300 Spartans. He also kept a contingent of soldiers from the small city of Thespiae, who reportedly refused to leave. According to Spartan custom, a Spartan soldier either won or died. There was no honorable retreat. Leonidas and his men died fighting. The story of Thermopylae was immediately recognized as something extraordinary. These men had known they would die and had chosen to stand anyway. When a Persian emissary came before the battle and told the Greeks that Persian arrows were so numerous they would block out the sun, a Spartan soldier named Dinases reportedly replied, "Good. Then we shall have our battle in the shade." Whether or not those exact words were spoken, the spirit they represent became legendary. Thermopylae was a military defeat, but it was a moral victory that echoed through centuries. With the pass taken, the Persians swept southward. Athens was evacuated. The women, children, and elderly were sent to the island of Salamis and other safe locations. When the Persian army entered Athens, they found it nearly empty, and they burned it. The Acropolis, the great rocky hill at the center of the city where Athens's most sacred temples stood, was set on fire. Watching from the island of Salamis, the Athenians could see the smoke rising from their burning city. The Greek fleet sheltered in the narrow channel of water between Salamis and the mainland. Some of the allied commanders wanted to sail further south, back to the safety of the Peloponnesian Peninsula. Themistocles understood that if the fleet scattered, the war was lost. He needed the Persians to attack in the narrows of Salamis, where the smaller Greek fleet could fight effectively. He did something bold and arguably treacherous. He sent a secret message to Xerxes suggesting that the Greek fleet was about to escape and that Xerxes should attack immediately and surround them. Xerxes, eager to finish the war quickly, took the bait. The Battle of Salamis in 480 BCE was the turning point. The Persian fleet was larger, but in the cramped, narrow waters of the Salamis Strait, its size became a disadvantage rather than a strength. The ships crowded together, unable to maneuver, rammed into each other. The Greek triremes, crewed by experienced Athenian oarsmen who had been training for years on ships funded by Themistocles and the silver of Laurium, rowed out and tore into the confusion. Xerxes watched from a golden throne on a hilltop overlooking the battle as his fleet was destroyed. When it became clear that the battle was lost, Xerxes retreated northward with a large part of his army, fearing that the Greeks would now sail north and destroy the boat bridges over the Hellespont, cutting off his route home. He left behind a substantial Persian army under the command of Mardonius, the same general who had led the first invasion 10 years earlier. In the spring of 479 BCE, this army marched south and occupied Athens again. Then it moved into the region of Boeotia and camped near the city of Plataea. The Greek alliance assembled the largest combined hoplite army it had ever put in the field and marched to meet them. The Battle of Plataea was a messy, complicated affair. It took days of maneuvering and positioning before the main clash came. When it did, the Greek hoplites, led by the Spartan general Pausanias, proved decisively superior in close combat. Mardonius himself was killed. The Persian camp, full of gold, silver, embroidered tents, and treasures from across the empire, was captured. Herodotus tells the touching story of Spartan soldiers who, after capturing the Persian camp, ordered the Persian cooks to prepare a Persian royal meal, and then stared in amazement at the lavish food, the golden tableware, and the extraordinary luxury, and then had their own simple Spartan meal of black broth and barley bread set out side by side with it for comparison. Whether this story is perfectly accurate or not, it captures the cultural gap between the two worlds. According to Herodotus, on the same day as Plataea, the Greek fleet also destroyed the remaining Persian ships and forces at the Battle of Mycale on the Ionian coast. If this simultaneous timing is accurate, it is almost poetically perfect. On one day, the land war and the sea war both ended with decisive Greek victories. What did all of this mean? The consequences were enormous and complicated. For Athens, the victory was transformative. Athens had provided the navy that won the war. It emerged from the conflict as the dominant sea power in the Greek world. It organized a new alliance called the Delian League, named after the island of Delos where the alliance's treasury was initially kept. The stated purpose was to continue the campaign against Persia and liberate the remaining Ionian Greeks. Member states contributed either ships or money. Over time, most states preferred to give money rather than ships, which meant Athens was building all the ships and Athens was gaining all the power. The League's treasury was eventually moved to Athens itself. Athens used this money to build the Parthenon, the magnificent temple to the goddess Athena that still stands, ruined but magnificent, on the Acropolis today. The Delian League had quietly become an Athenian empire. The wealth and security this empire provided fueled what historians call the Athenian Golden Age, roughly the 50 years between 480 and 430 BCE. During this period, the playwrights Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides were writing tragedies that explored the deepest questions of human existence. The philosopher Socrates was walking the streets of Athens asking uncomfortable questions about justice and virtue. The historian Herodotus was writing the world's first systematic attempt to explain a major historical event. The sculptor Phidias was creating works of such perfection that ancient people considered them among the wonders of the world. The statesman Pericles was overseeing the construction of the Parthenon and pushing Athenian democracy toward a more fully developed form. None of this was inevitable. Without the victory over Persia, none of it might have happened. For Persia, the defeats were painful but not fatal. The empire lost its western campaigns and suffered enormous military losses, but it remained intact and powerful for another 150 years, until Alexander the Great finally destroyed it in the 330s BCE. The Persians adapted their strategy. Rather than trying to conquer Greece with armies, they increasingly used money, sending gold to support whichever Greek city would fight against Athens or Sparta. Persian diplomats became experts at encouraging the Greeks to destroy each other, and Greek wars of the 5th and 4th centuries were frequently funded by Persian gold. This strategy eventually worked. The Great Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta, which raged from 431 to 404 BCE and destroyed Athenian power, was partly enabled by Persian financial support for Sparta. But perhaps the most lasting consequence of the Greco-Persian Wars was not military or political. It was a story, an idea, a way of understanding the conflict that the Greeks themselves invented and that has never stopped shaping how people think. The Greek historian Herodotus, writing in the generation after the wars, framed the entire conflict as a clash between two fundamentally different ways of organizing human life. On the Greek side stood Eleutheria, a Greek word meaning freedom. The Greeks, particularly the Athenians, governed themselves through assemblies and elections. Citizens could speak in public debates and vote on laws. Leaders could be removed from power. On the Persian side stood what the Greeks called doulia, meaning slavery or servitude. In Persia, all people, from the greatest noble to the humblest farmer, were technically subjects of the king. When the Persian herald came to Greek cities demanding earth and water as tokens of submission, the Greeks who resisted saw this as the starkest possible expression of the difference between the two worlds. The Greeks would debate and decide together, the Persians would obey. This framing, freedom against tyranny, democracy against despotism, the free West against the enslaved East, became one of the most powerful and enduring ideas in history. The Romans picked it up. European thinkers during the Enlightenment, the great intellectual movement of the 17th and 18th centuries that questioned traditional authority and celebrated human reason, picked it up again. When people today talk about Western values including democracy, individual rights, and freedom of speech, they are often tracing a line of ideas that leads back, through many twists and complications, to how the Greeks chose to explain their victory over Persia. But here we must pause and be honest about something. Modern historians have strong reasons to question this simple picture. The freedom versus tyranny narrative was written by Greeks, for Greeks, after a Greek victory. It was, in modern language, propaganda as much as history. Consider what the narrative leaves out. Athens, the great defender of freedom, kept slaves. A large part of the Athenian economy ran on enslaved people who had no freedom at all. Athens denied political rights to women and to men who were not born to Athenian parents. The Delian League, born from the war against tyranny, quickly became an Athenian empire in which smaller cities were forced to contribute money under threat of military punishment. And what about Persia? The Persian Empire was sophisticated, complex, and often genuinely tolerant. Persian kings allowed conquered peoples to keep their religions and customs. The administrative system that Darius built was remarkably efficient. Many peoples within the empire lived peacefully and prospered. To describe the entire Persian world as simply a land of slaves and tyranny is to flatten and misrepresent a civilization of great complexity and achievement. Many historians today argue that the East versus West framework tells us far more about what the Greeks wanted to believe about themselves than it tells us about what Persia was actually like. There is also the matter of Herodotus himself. He is our main source, indeed almost our only detailed source, for these wars. He is often called the father of history, meaning he was one of the first people to systematically investigate and write about past events rather than simply telling myths. His work is genuinely remarkable, but he was also a storyteller who loved a good narrative. His numbers for the Persian army are almost certainly too high. Some of the speeches and conversations he records are almost certainly invented or heavily embellished. He sometimes includes contradictory accounts and lets readers decide which to believe. Modern historians use him gratefully and critically at the same time, which is exactly the right approach. This brings us to a genuinely interesting question that historians still argue about. Were the Greco-Persian Wars truly the birth of Western civilization? The answer is almost certainly, partly yes, in a real way, and partly no, in an equally real way. The yes part, the Athenian Golden Age that followed the wars, produced genuine intellectual and artistic achievements that later European civilization genuinely did learn from, adopt, and build upon. Democracy as an idea, tragedy as an art form, systematic historical inquiry, philosophical questioning of fundamental assumptions, these things were developed in Athens in the decades after the Persian Wars. They were real achievements. And the confidence and resources that flowed from the victory made them possible. The no part, the idea that history has always been a contest between a free West and a tyrannical East, is a simplification that distorts more than it illuminates. It ignores the enormous contributions of Middle Eastern, Egyptian, and other civilizations to what became Greek culture in the first place. It turns a specific historical conflict into a timeless cosmic battle that conveniently always makes one side look like the hero. It has been used throughout history to justify colonialism and other forms of domination by telling people that some civilizations are fundamentally freer and better than others. The truth is more interesting than either the simple heroic story or its complete rejection. What happened at Marathon, Thermopylae, Salamis, and Plataea was a genuine collision of two different political cultures, and the Greek victory did have real consequences for the specific history of Athens, Greece, and eventually Europe. But those consequences were complicated, mixed, and often contradicted the values the Greeks said they were fighting for. The lesson is not that Greeks were heroes and Persians were villains, or vice versa. The lesson is that history is made by people with mixed motivations, limited information, and an understandable desire to tell stories about themselves that make them look good. That desire to tell self-flattering stories is itself one of the most enduring features of human civilization. From Herodotus writing that Persian arrows would blot out the sun, allowing Greeks to fight in the shade, to the way nations today celebrate their own founding victories, we are all still doing exactly what the Greeks did after Marathon, trying to find a story that makes our struggles feel meaningful and our victories feel inevitable. The Greco-Persian Wars matter not just because they happened, but because of the stories people told about them, and because understanding both the events and the stories, and the gap between them, is one of the best ways to understand how human societies construct their own identities. To summarize the key ideas we have covered, the wars began not with a Persian invasion but with the Ionian Revolt of 499 BCE. in which Athens helped Ionian Greeks rebel against Persian rule, King Darius launched two invasions in revenge. The first ended in Persian defeat at the Battle of Marathon in 490 BCE, where Athenian hoplites used superior tactics to crush a larger Persian force. In the decade before the second invasion, Themistocles persuaded Athens to build a fleet of triremes using newly discovered silver. Xerxes launched the second invasion with a massive army in 480 BCE. The Spartan king Leonidas delayed the Persians at Thermopylae before being betrayed and killed. The Persians burned Athens, but Themistocles lured the Persian fleet into the narrow Strait of Salamis and destroyed it. The following year, the final Persian land army was crushed at Plataea. The victory created an Athenian empire and funded a golden age of extraordinary cultural achievement. The Greeks framed the conflict as freedom against tyranny, an idea that became foundational to later notions of Western civilization, though modern historians rightly point out that this narrative was one-sided, ignored Greek slavery and imperialism, and oversimplified the sophisticated Persian civilization. The wars are genuinely important, but they are most valuable when we understand them in their full complexity, rather than as a simple story of good defeating evil.